This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Alan Cumming, has written a new memoir in which he explains that at some of his greatest career highs, he's been unhappy and confused. At his most celebrated, he's felt the lowest self-esteem. He traces some of this to his relationship with his father, who tormented him psychologically and beat him. Cumming also writes about his two marriages and his understanding of his own sexuality. In his 20s, he was married to a woman. Their relationship lasted about 8 years. He's been with his husband for 17 years. Cumming's memoir is also filled with insights about acting. Cumming became famous in the U.S. for his Tony Award-winning performance in the 1998 Broadway revival of Cabaret. He played the MC in a Berlin nightclub in 1929 and 30, as the Nazis are gaining power, but people in the Cabaret are oblivious to what that means. Cumming's interpretation of the character emphasized the sexuality and debauchery of the club's culture. In 2014, that production was revived, with Cumming again playing the MC. Cumming was nominated for 3 Emmys and 2 Golden Globes for his performance in the TV series The Good Wife. His movies include the Kubrick film Eyes Wide Shut, the Bond film Golden Eye, the X-Men film X2, and the Spy Kids trilogy. His cabaret act, Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs, was broadcast on PBS. He co-starred in the recent series Schmigadoon, a loving spoof of musicals from the 1940s and 50s. Let's start with the opening song from Cabaret.
Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Fremda, étranger, stranger. Glücklich zu sehen, je suis enchanté. Happy to see you, bleib, rest, stay. Welcome, bienvenue, welcome. In cabaret, au cabaret, au cabaret. Meine Damen und Herren, Mesdames et Messieurs, Ladies and Gentlemen, guten Abend, bonsoir.
Alan Cumming, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So you came to New York to do Cabaret, and you say that it was an unusual feeling to not have people make assumptions about your class or about your intelligence because you were Scottish. What were the assumptions in Britain about you because of your accent?
Yeah, before I came to New York, I was living in London, and you know, there's quite a lot of baggage, as it were, being a Scot living in London, being from outside of the southeast of England and living, and coming to live in London. It's not just about Scottish people. Irish people get it. People who from the north of England get it too. But there's the class system in Britain is pretty still incredibly vivid, and also the whole kind of nationality thing. There was a sort of ancient historical persecution of Scotland by the English over the years. So what it meant to me, though, personally, was that how I sounded would mean that people would assume things about my education, my intelligence, my class, and they were always not, you know, very positive things in their minds. So when I came to America, when I came to New York, I didn't really realize all this when I was living in London. It was just part of this sort of subliminal thing that you just had to deal with. It was part of what it was like living in London. And so when I came to New York, that's when I realized, because I was being sort of celebrated for all the things that I was slightly derided for as a Scot in London. People liked my voice. People liked how I thought. People liked that I was different. And that's when I kind of realized that I'd been living with that, and that Scottish people live with that, and just because of where they're from when they come down south.
We talked a lot about Cabaret in our 2014 interview, so I don't want to go over the same territory. But I was really interested to read in the book that when you were first offered Cabaret, you declined. You didn't want to be in a musical. Why didn't you want to be in a musical?
I just felt, I was being snobby, I suppose. I just didn't quite, I just felt musicals weren't for me. It was very much, you know, I hadn't done anything like that. I'd sort of, even the sort of stand-up comedy act that I did where we sang, we kind of were parodying and slightly looking down on that sort of, you know, and taking the mickey out of musicals in a way. I just felt it was not my thing. I saw musicals as something light, and I was, you know, I was a serious actor. I was literally doing Hamlet right before I did the MC. So I think it was just my youthful arrogance, I suppose, and also slight, and also fear. But luckily Sam Mendes sort of, you know, persuaded me, and I realised that my fear about doing a show like Cabaret, which is about a very serious subject, doing that in the form of a musical, which by its very nature has to have certain tropes that to me can sometimes demean the material. That was my worry, and that was also, Sam had thought about that through and thought that through. And, you know, the production that we both wanted to do the same thing, I guess, which was do this very kind of gritty, earthy production. And also, Cabaret is a good musical in that there's a reason why you burst into song, certainly for my character, because he's a performer in a club. So it's not quite, I mean, I still have trouble with, you know, I'm talking now and now I'm singing. I still have trouble with that. And when I'm trying to be sort of, you know, when I can do it in a sort of a parody way, in a way that's heightened. But if I'm trying to be a real person, I still have some problems with that. I'm working on it, though.
Were you comfortable singing in character?
Yes. I singing in character is much easier. You have this sort of veil of the character between you and the audience. I find it really difficult. And, you know, I started doing my own concerts about 10 years ago or so. And that was a huge, terrifying leap to suddenly sing as me. And I'm so glad. I love it now, and I'm really glad I've done it. And I do these concerts all over the place. And it's been an incredible thing for my confidence and for my, and also the way that I sort of want to, you know, what I want to talk about. Each show sort of has a theme. The one I'm doing currently is about sort of aging. It's called Alan Cumming's Not Acting His Age. I feel I can actually say things that I want to say, using the sort of medium of cabaret, a true cabaret of, you know, talking about stuff, singing a song that kind of illustrates that, making people think, making people laugh, making people cry. That is, I'm really glad I'm doing that. But it was very, very, very scary to step outside a character and say, this is me.
So you were reluctant to do Cabaret when it was offered to you. You didn't want to be in a musical. You were uncomfortable about musicals. Now that you've been in an exceptionally successful musical, you were in another musical very recently, and this was a parody of classic Americana kind of musicals from the 1950s called Schmigadoon. It was a streaming series that I just really loved. So describe the character that you played in Schmigadoon. And Schmigadoon, it's Schmigadoon as in Brigadoon, because the musicals that are parodied in this include, like, The Music Men, Guys and Dolls,
Carousel.
Oklahoma, Carousel, Brigadoon. Did I mention Brigadoon already? Yeah.
Yes. So Keegan-Michael Key and Cecily Strong play a couple in the present time who go on this kind of get away from it all, make your relationship better, sort of outward bound weekend, and they get lost when they're on a hike, and they go over this little bridge, and they, like in Brigadoon, they come to this magical land called Schmigadoon, where everyone is sort of a character from a 1950s, 1940s Hollywood musical. So it's just this, it's actually a really clever thing, because it's a parody and a homage at the same time.
So you play this very repressed character, like you're the mayor, and one day in the woods, the Cecily Strong character sees you, and she's very confused about, like, who she's in love with, and, you know, whether she should be breaking up with the person who she was partners with. And you sing the song Somewhere Love Is Waiting For You, and the deeper you get into the song, the more you realize, the more viewers realize, you're singing about yourself and that you're gay and so deep in the closet, like, you can't reveal that even hardly to yourself, let alone to anybody else. So let's hear this song.
Somewhere love is waiting for you. Someday it will come right on cue. Just as every morning the sun comes into view. Somewhere love is waiting for you.
Oh, am I supposed to
And see? When you find him, bells won't be ringing, no angels singing to lead you to him.
But when you find him, a little voice leaves you no choice but to pursue him. Then he'll smile at you, place your hand in his, and at once you'll know what contentment is. Then he'll hold you close in his strong tanned arms, and your heart's afire, setting off alarms. At last the love that was forbidden no longer must be hidden. Somewhere love is waiting for you.
That is so much fun. And of course, the love that was forbidden is your own love for another man.
Yes. For Fred.
For Fred Armisen. Yeah. So did you go back to the source material and try to figure out what songs inspired this song?
No. I mean, I didn't. It's an amalgam of lots of different sort of songs from all those shows. The thing that the Cinco Paul who wrote it, you know, he sort of said a sort of a Nelson Eddy style of kind of performance for it. So that was kind of more what I focused on, that kind of, and I love that way that people, you know, like things that are spelt S-I, like singing, S-I-N-G, or ringing. It's the, you make an E sound. You say singing instead, or, you know, I'm bells won't be ringing. It's just hysterical to me, that weird, slightly faux operatic vowel sounds that singers like of this style of song sing. So I really tried to do that. I really tried to sort of parody a style of singing more than a style of a song.
Your first memoir had a lot to do with your childhood growing up and your father's emotional and physical abuse. I mean, he tormented you, he beat you. You still write about some of that in your new memoir. And you tell this really horrible story about being locked in this tube. Your father was a forester. Can you give us the short version of that story?
It's a thing called a cellcure plant. It was a thing that would, a little sort of railway, would go into this big metal tube, and then it had wood on these little trolleys, and then they would sort of vacuum seal this big tube, and then all this.
This was to like cure the wood with some kind of chemical, right?
To make it more hard wearing and to last, you know, for like this sort of, that sort of green colour you see wood and sort of fence posts and things have. What happened was that one time the little chains that kept the wood on the little trolleys broke, and the wood kind of fell out, and so the thing was blocked, it couldn't come out. And so my job was, I was little, I had to crawl along the edge of this slimy, green, chemically tube and kind of try and pull the blocked wood out. And when I was inside doing that, I had said to my dad, please don't shut the door. Because I was really scared he was going to shut the door on me. And he did. He shut this big door, and I was suddenly in the dark and all this big sort of chemical, you know, prison. And he just did it as a joke, just to be funny. And but that's, I write about that in this book as a way to just say I still, that's one of my nightmares that I have, a recurring nightmare I have, that he opened the door again, and I dream that he's going to lock the door, and I'm going to be drowned in all this cell cure chemical. So I write about, I mean, I in my first book I talked in a lot of detail about my childhood. In this book I sort of talk about the shadow of it, I think, and also the fact that after writing the first memoir, I sort of in some way foolishly thought that I would have some sort of closure or something with my dad. But actually, of course, he came back into my life in a way, a much more vivid and present way than ever before. And I actually realise now that is as it should be. He is my father, but he's in my life now on my terms. And I just wanted to kind of talk back a little at the notion from the first memoir that somehow I was cured and overcome and I triumphed all my sort of childhood abuse. And I feel I want to say, no, you still have it. I still have these dreams. I still have things that trigger me. And I feel that the most important thing is never to deny what's happened to you.
I'm just thinking about how not funny and how very cruel it was of your father to lock you in, however briefly, in this tube, this big canister filled with a chemical. And now that we know so much more about the toxic qualities and the long-lasting toxic qualities of many chemicals. I mean,
there's nothing good about it. Yeah,
it's just a horror show.
It's a horror. I mean, and that was one of many sort of similar. I mean, it wasn't just physical. You know, he was violent, but it was also like that. He did these really weird sort of sick kind of games, and you're right. He tormented me and my brother.
How aware was your mother of what your father was doing, and how did she handle it? And I'm wondering if he's been dead a few years. So when you say he's a presence in your life, you mean like a psychological presence. He's not a physically living presence anymore. But your mother is still alive.
My mother is very much alive and kicking. Yes, I saw her yesterday. I'm talking about him now. You know, I talk about him. He's much more present in when I do interviews now. It's you know, because I did sort of come out, as it were, as someone who had an abusive childhood. I feel that's very much a part of my identity, and I feel I've welcomed him back in, or allowed him back in. I was sort of in denial about him for a long time. I sort of didn't even remember many of the things that happened to me. So my mum, you know, we all lived in terror. I mean, if you live in terror, it's a sort of paralyzing thing. There was nothing any of us could have done. We lived in fear of our lives. And I think she eventually got away from my dad, and I really admire her. I really admire the kind of, you know, she's a survivor too, and she made a life for herself and went on to find happiness with someone else. And I think that's sort of, you know, testament to her character and her strength.
You were already out of the house when she did that.
Yeah, I left, you know, when I was 17. I went to drama school as quickly as I could. I sort of fled, and but it was very many years after that before I could even remember things or even countenance the idea of sort of confronting my own past, my own memories. It was, in a way, my body was protecting me from, I was too little and too young to process what was happening to me. A child shouldn't have to deal with that. So I think my body kind of just said, okay, we're not going to actually deal with that right now. We're going to just store that away somewhere. And then when I was starting to try to become a father myself, I feel that's when that unlocked all those memories about my own father.
When those memories started coming back to you, did you trust the memories? And was there anybody who you could talk to who could say, yeah, that really happened?
The person that I was able to be reassured by that it had happened was my brother. But of course, I think if anyone has had experience of remembering abuse and that you can't believe it happened to you, saying it aloud so you have to, I mean, it's really important to be believed. Partly because you can't believe it yourself, and actually saying it, you know, a good abuser relies on you protecting them because you're so ashamed of what's happening to you. So actually finally saying this happened to me is such a huge maelstrom of emotion. And so it is very important to be believed. And if people doubt you, or as happened to me, because I was leaving a relationship whilst all that was going on, to sort of hurt you, to sort of say that it's not true and that I was making it up, that was very, very difficult.
You write about that you didn't talk to your father for about 16 years, but you mentioned that you and your brother returned to see your father and to confront him. What did you say to each other? Are you comfortable talking about that?
I wrote it all down, what I wanted to say. And I said, you know, we remember these incidents of violence and abuse, and we listed some of the things, I was getting a lot of therapy at the time, and I tried not to be too sort of, you know, therapy speak with him. I tried to say, I want to understand why you did that, and if there was something, do you think there's something that happened to you that made you behave in that way? And, you know, we did all that. And I just felt, I said, the reason we are here today is to give you this back. We have carried this thing that didn't belong to us. And we feel, we understand that it happened now, but we want to give it back to you and to take it all out in the open, say that it happened and see if we can continue having a relationship. But if we're going to continue, you have to come back with us, to us, willing to discuss this and willing to, sort of explain, it's happened now, it's never not going to happen, but maybe you could make it clearer for us why you think it happened, what was going on in your life, and maybe, you know, you let us know if you actually still want to be in our lives. So we did that in a very, you know, we thought about it a lot, and it was a terrifying experience because we were having this conversation in the place where we had had the abuse. And we went for a walk around the estate, actually, to not be in the house. And it was scary. I thought my dad's going to hit me at one point. And at the end, when we drove away, I could see he had tears in his eyes, and we sort of left the door open for him. And my brother said this hilarious thing to me, like, when we got in the car and we were both just shaking, and, you know, it was an incredible experience. And he said to me, gosh, Alan, you hardly looked at the script at all. That's what he said to me, because I had this piece of paper with all the things I wanted to say. And he made it like I was acting a scene, which I thought was kind of perfect, actually. But then we never heard from him again. The next time I heard from my father was many years later, when he got in touch via my brother to tell me that I wasn't his biological son. That was the next time I heard from him.
But you did some research and DNA testing, and you found out that
I was his son. Yeah, I was his son. I was. So I had to.
Why did he say that you were not his biological son? Did he believe that?
He totally believed it, and it was fascinating. I mean, you know, it was very difficult and emotional, and it's insane. To actually, when it was happening. But now, you know, looking back at it, it's kind of fascinating that at some point he made something that was maybe a little niggly thing, a little sort of suspicion, into the truth for him. I think partly to justify in his mind the way he was behaving to my mother in terms of the affairs he was having, and also to me in terms of... But it doesn't quite make sense because, you know, he hit my brother as well. The logic of it is not quite clear, but... When I had the last time I spoke to him, I called him up and said, I have got the results of the DNA test. I am your son. And he said, I mean, imagine having that conversation. And he said, well, I'm very surprised to hear that. And I was like, I bet you are. And he said to me, he said things like, I had to believe it, Alan. I said, no, you didn't. You chose to believe it. And he said things like, you know, did you not notice that we never bonded? I was like, yes, believe me, I noticed. It was just like I was dealing with a child. And I eventually had to say to him, you know, I'm going to stop this conversation now, and I won't talk to you again. We won't be speaking again. It's really difficult because you can't expect rationality from an irrational person. I think he was mentally ill. I think he had certain personality disorders, and goodness knows what happened to him when he was a little boy. He certainly didn't break the cycle, I think. But it was crazy.
When you were a teenager and decided you wanted to act and started studying drama, was it a relief to get out of yourself and become other people?
Yes, Yes, it was. And I think that's still something that I feel is, you know, a great attraction for me about acting. I just love the idea that I play someone completely different to myself. I think obviously then it was more about the fact that if I dwelt too much on my present, I mean, I kind of wasn't doing that. I was kind of just not processing it. I was just moving through it, trying to just being quite blinkered. But the idea of being someone else, being someone completely different, was very liberating and fun and, you know, and easy. So, yeah, that was a great thing.
You know, you write in your memoir about your marriage to your wife, who you married when you were in your 20s, I think. And then...
Yes, 21.
Your marriage to your husband, and you've been together for about 17 years. You say that, you know, after you were married for a while, you realized that you needed to make a change, that you needed to get out of the marriage, but you weren't really sure how to do it. And you also were going through a really rough period. Correct me if I have the chronology wrong here, but there was a period when you were doing Hamlet at night and rehearsing Cabaret during the day, which was two extraordinary roles, but it turned out to be a very kind of dangerous brew for you because of the characters. What was seeping into your person from their characters that added to your depression and anxiety during that period?
Well, so Hamlet, I was playing someone who's having, you know, very difficult time with his family, who is being, you know, being asked to confront things about his dad. I was in Hamlet with, and the actress playing Ophelia was also my wife. In Cabaret, I was being sort of, I guess, having to mine my fantasies in terms of what the character would do sexually and things like that. There was just a lot going on. And I also at the time was trying to become a father. I mean, the real sort of thing that precipitated my sort of breakdown was that, was unleashing all those memories from my childhood. But playing those two parts, you're first of all exhausted, but also there's sort of certain kind of, you know, things that are unleashed because of what you're dealing with. I didn't leave the work at home. I didn't leave work at the theatre. I took it home. I took the sort of angst and the despair of Hamlet home with me, and that was a disaster. I learned that lesson, but it was a very, very difficult lesson to learn.
I think it must have been really complicated to be thinking, do I really want to be a father? Do I even really want to stay in this marriage? Well, at the same time, playing opposite your wife every night on stage because you were Hamlet and she was Ophelia.
Yeah, it was a hot mess. It was a total hot mess.
Yeah.
And really, it was just, you know, and then suddenly saying to someone, you know, who you've been very assiduously trying to get pregnant with, suddenly saying, oh, I don't want to do this anymore. In fact, I don't even know if I want to be with you. I don't know why. I'm just feeling really weird and depressed and incapable of choosing my clothes in the morning. I mean, it was just, and also not eating. That was another thing. It kind of had a sort of burgeoning eating disorder around about that time. So it was just, one of the things about writing about yourself is, you know, and going back and researching, because I felt such compassion for my younger self. I really, you know, I was several times thinking, oh my God, you poor little thing. That was a lot to deal with.
I want to ask you about working with Stanley Kubrick. You were in his 1997 film, Eyes Wide Shut. And it's funny, you know, you auditioned with an American accent. Mm-hmm. And then when he saw you as yourself, after you got the part, he said, you're not American. You were American on the tapes. Were you afraid?
He was furious.
Yeah. Why was he angry? And what did you fear the consequences would be? Did you fear there would be consequences?
It's sort of funny. I felt kind of I mean, I'd never met him until I'd only auditioned on tape and for some producers. I'd never actually met Stanley. So the first day I was meeting him was I walk on onto the soundstage. There's Tom Cruise, there's Stanley Kubrick, and there's me. And I said, hello, Stanley, I'm Alan. And he seemed really kind of disgruntled. And he was like, you're not American, like that. And kind of grumpy. And I was like, yes, I know, I'm Scottish. And he said, you're American on the tape. And I did this thing that I sort of felt I had nothing to lose, actually. I felt that, you know, I wanted to be in this film. I'd sort of held out, taken some time off to wait for it to happen. But also, you know, it was 6 o'clock in the morning. I'd been hanging around for months to do this little part. And here's this old man sort of being annoyed with me because I wasn't the nationality that I'd been pretending to be on the tape. And that I was just like, oh, you know, oh, I was going to swear there, I'm not allowed to, but I was basically like, you know, F off Stanley Kubrick. And so I said to him, he said, you were American on the tape. And I just said, yeah, that's because I'm an actor, Stanley. And he looked at me with this kind of sort of over his glasses and kind of thought, you know, you're kind of interesting. And after that, we got on like a house on fire. I think because I stood up to him. And I think it's an interesting thing about people who are perceived as gruff and scary and maybe even a bully, that if you serve them, if you give them that type of behaviour, if you are scared and walk on eggshells around them, I think it only, you know, it's a self-perpetuating thing. And if you kind of challenge them and just sort of say, you know, I think you're being unreasonable, I think they sort of snap out of it, and I think they're quite happy to not be sort of having to fulfill their own perceived destiny. So that was the case with him, and we really did get on like a house on fire, and I really liked him, and I really felt that tiny part in that movie was really invigorating for me as an actor. I sort of was bored of acting and film acting at the time, and it just kind of made me excited about, you know, like just doing that tiny little scene, but every little moment was packed with nuance, and every take we did, I knew exactly what we were trying to achieve. And that actually doesn't happen very often. Often you don't really know why you're doing it again, you're just doing it again. And with Stanley, it was completely clear to me always.
Yeah, you said that if it wasn't for Kubrick, you might not still be an actor today. Tell us a little more about working with him. Like when he would ask you for another take, what would he tell you about what he wanted?
He would be very, it might even be like a little, very minute sort of moment. He would take you to the monitor and you'd watch what the previous take, and he would point to a little moment here, and it could even be a gesture. I mean, it was like a dance. It was like a very detailed, choreographed dance. And also he would say, you know, let's try, take it a bit further. Let's kind of up the ante, to the point where I was saying to him, like me, Alan Cumming, is saying to him, that's too much, Stanley. I think we're going too far. And he'd go, no, go on. So I met my match in terms of, you know, big performances, heightened performances. Because there's a saying in Scotland is you can be as big as you like as long as you mean it. And I feel that was, Stanley thought that too, obviously.
You've written several books, including fiction and two memoirs. You were writing when you were a teenager. You got a job at a publishing company that did, I think, newspapers and magazines?
Yes, yeah, D.C. Thompson, it's called.
And so this was in Scotland?
This is in Scotland, it's in Dundee. I left school at 16. I thought, what am I going to do? I was going to be sort of chucked out of the house unless I got a job. And my mum saw the ad in the newspaper for like a sub-editor at this publishing house. And so I applied and got it. And again, it was just, you know, I feel like in my life, I haven't really had a plan B. I don't really think ahead in that way. And I knew I was going to apply to drama school, but I only applied to one drama school. And if I hadn't got this job, I don't know quite what I would have done.
One of the things you did when you were working for this publishing company is you started modeling for photo stories. And one
yes.
of the photos you reprint
I'm
in
so
the book.
I'm so glad this is a radio program and we can't show the actual pictures.
Oh, but I'm going to describe it with your help. So,
oh, God.
There's a photo of you with you're lying on your side with your head propped up on your elbow. You're wearing these like short shorts, a sleeveless t-shirt,
very
one of those
short.
Like strap t-shirts.
I think there's a headband, isn't there?
And headband, yes, because this is like a 1970s yeah. kind of thing, or 80s. Mm-hmm. And it, you really look like you're posing for a gay magazine. mm-hmm. But it was just it was a teen magazine. What do you think about
teen,
when you...
He was like, well, it was such... I mean, that one was hilarious. It was that was a sort of a 10-part photo love story. And it was about this boy who he couldn't... It was called The One and Only. And he said he can't find love because he's too busy trying to be the next Leroy from Fame. Like he wanted to be a dancer in a, and I just thought perhaps the fact that he's so obsessed with Leroy from Fame is why he's not finding a girlfriend. Nobody else seemed to think that. But yeah, I mean, I look back and I think actually it's you know, the thing you mentioned earlier that I always looked younger than I actually was. When I was 16, 17 doing those things, I feel I looked about 13 or 14. I feel it was like weird, you know, and that's... That's another thing about looking back and writing about yourself, and is that you partly have that thing about feeling compassion for yourself, that you see how young you were, and not just how young you were, but even like you looked, and I was kind of immature. You know, I wasn't very worldly, and I was in these situations that I feel sort of concerned for myself now looking back at.
Thank you so much for coming back to our show. I really enjoyed speaking with you again.
It's always lovely to be probed by you, Terry.
I like the way you said that.
Mercilessly probed.
It sounds like a horrible visit to the doctor's office. Alan Cumming, thank you again.
Thank you.
Alan Cumming's new memoir is called Baggage. Here's a song from the album of his cabaret show, Alan Cumming Sings Sappy Songs. This is the Noel Coward song, If Love Were All.
I believe in doing what I can, crying when I must, laughing when I choose. Hey-ho, if love were all, I believe the more you love a man, the more you give your trust, the more you're bound to lose. Although when shadows fall, I think if only somebody splendid really needed me. Someone affectionate and dear. Cares would be ended if I knew that he wanted to have me near. But I believe...
This is Fresh Air.